being a teenager, I dealt with every feeling that I'd ever had through using substances. All of these things that I thought I was, and all of the direction that I thought I was going in, just turns out to be wrong, and I've got to change it all, otherwise I'm going to die. So I think I was two things. I didn't really want to be either of them. I didn't want to be this kind of buttoned up management consultant type, and neither did I want to be this kind of frightened, hidden, shame infested person.
Breakdown Wake Up is about discovering the groundbreaking wisdom within our most challenging life stories. I'm Meg Mateer, a psychology nerd turned business consultant and entrepreneur. Join me to hear from leaders about when things in their lives were breaking down and to listen for the wisdom waking up. Along the way, we'll explore fresh perspectives like how distress is a driver of success, not a barrier to it. How our personal and professional lives are inherently connected, and how our individual experiences can help solve broader societal challenges. Daniel Pearson and I speak about his own experience with coming to terms with a diagnosis of bipolar disorder and addiction after he hit a rock bottom in his late 20s. And a core theme that you could see throughout the conversation is this idea of secrecy and shame and hiding around aspects of ourselves that are less acceptable in the world. And what's amazing is that by sharing his story with me and with all of you, Daniel actually breaks that cycle. He begins to shift that dynamic. He breaks that cycle not just for himself and his own story, but he breaks that cycle for many of us. We all have aspects of ourselves, of our own personal life story that we may be embarrassed about, or that there's some shame around, or that we've learned have no place in our personal or professional lives. But there's something that changes when we can actually acknowledge and integrate those aspects into ourselves. So that's what he's really done. He's moved from feeling like he lived a double life, the first where he was in this professional role as a very successful consultant, and the other, this scared person trying to deal with all sorts of challenging life situations from his past, to being one person and incorporating that into his life. So pay attention to that theme as you listen to this episode. Daniel, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, great to be here.
You are a partner at EY, one of the world's largest international financial and strategic consulting firms. Over the last 15 years at EY, you've held various internal and client-facing strategy-focused functions. Now, in your current role, you're responsible for shaping the strategic direction of EY's advisory practice globally, steering large commercial opportunities based around alternative business models, and leading EY's global program execution services function. Prior to this, you were a consultant at IBM, and you also studied philosophy at the University of Cambridge. So great to have you on the Breakdown Wake Up podcast.
It's great to be here, and very, very good research.
So yeah, I'm curious. Tell me a little bit more about what your role, your current role, entails at EY, because it's quite a unique and special one.
I really love my job, and I'm very lucky to have the job I have, because it involves doing something which I have come over the course of my career to really enjoy, which is working on really complex strategy problems, and kind of problems that involve technical complexity, so difficult content, but also people and political complexity. And that's probably the thing that's in common across everything I do. It involves kind of figuring out how to move complex stuff forward through really kind of complex stakeholders and kind of people issues as well. So I guess that's the bit that I love and the bit that kind of knits all that together.
And so you're working also across like all different stakeholders within the firm on these strategic initiatives as well.
Yeah, that's right. So my role is a global role. So it involves interfacing with kind of leaders of EY all around the world.
How do you manage that like technical and political complexity?
So I've learned a couple of things. So one is patience. So being patient, and I would probably give myself a 5 out of 10 on the patience scale, and that's been a big increase in that, but it could always be more patient, but yeah, patience is really important, and understanding and listening to people, really properly understanding where their perspectives are coming from. I would also say just not being wedded too much to my own ideas. I think it's very easy to become wedded to your own ideas, but when you're in a complex situation with 5 other people with all of their ideas and you're trying to find a way forward, quite important to focus on their ideas and not make it even more complicated with six ideas. Not to say I don't have an opinion, obviously, but I think I'm really careful about when to have an opinion and when to simply listen to others, really. So
I'm really curious to hear more about the story that you wanted to share on this podcast about your own experience of breaking down and waking up. Tell me, like, where does that start?
This story starts for me when I was about 30, in my late 20s, about 30. And sort of prior to that, I'd probably been, I was working at EY, doing my consulting and stuff, and I was probably, doing well. Probably people thought I was a bit of a heavy drinker and, enjoyed life and a little bit eccentric and stuff, but generally kind of had my shit together. And then within the space of about a year, 18 months, I was in a completely different state. I was completely unable to work. Like literally unable to do anything. Somebody asked me to make an agenda one day, could not remember what an agenda was. There was complete chaos in my personal life. So my personal relationships, my friendships, my family relationships. I was drinking all the time. I was doing things that were completely out of character. And I ended up in a psychiatric hospital. Now, when I got there, it kind of got worse. So what I thought was burnout turned out to be more serious. So I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which is, of course, very serious psychiatric illness. And as well as that, I was also diagnosed with addiction. In my case, that was addiction to alcohol, to prescription drugs. And I was basically told that if I didn't change everything in my life, including facing up to all of the causes of that and all of the kind of stuff in the background, and I didn't face up to that, I would be dead by the time I was 40. I'm 43 now, and kind of happy, healthy, in a completely different space. And so I guess the experience I wanted to talk about was how all that happened to me, and the recovery that came after that, and the insight and the kind of changes that experience had on me.
What were some of those first feelings that you had that, obviously escalated up into this going to the psychiatric institution?
Yeah, so hindsight is a great thing. One of the things that happened was a real secrecy. So I started doing things in secret. So I started, drinking on my own, and I didn't really acknowledge that was as much of a problem now as I do looking back. I started doing that. So around that, there were feelings of shame. So whenever you do things that are secret, sometimes you can feel shame about that, and I did. Fear, like looking back, I was more and more full of fear. So some of those kind of things, they built up really like a kind of pressure cooker.
So you went to the psychiatric institution in this state of really like crisis, sounds like a rock, almost like a rock bottom moment. And they had mentioned to you, you have this diagnosis of bipolar disorder. What was that like for you to have this diagnosis and then think, sort of reflect back on your life?
Yeah, well, by the time I ended up in psychiatric hospital, it was in fact a complete relief to receive that diagnosis. What had happened in the year before is that, you know, my behavior had gotten more and more out of sorts, and my ability to hide it, conceal it, had diminished really. So it's more and more visible to others. And, you know, I just really did not know what was going on. Much as I was in denial about my behavior, those around me can, you know, also went into denial. So people would minimize it. People would kind of, you know, it's very frightening when this happens to somebody. And so there was this year of kind of everyone knowing that something was wrong, but nobody really having the kind of insight to say what it was. So by the time I got to receive the diagnosis, it was a relief for that reason. So okay, here's something that I can do something with. But it also felt like a sentence, especially, you know, addiction as well. Actually, in some ways, that was worse because I didn't have any understanding of what addiction was, and it came with a whole load of connotations around shame. And frankly, just fear. I mean, what's my life going to be like? They've given me them. What's it going to be like? I mean, I remember when I was a teenager, my neighbour, he was a lovely, lovely guy. And he used to, but he led a very diminished life, and he had bipolar disorder. He used to, he had a cat, which he adored. And he used to plant seedlings and grow plants, which he loved doing. And he, you know, tended to these things, but that was what his life was. So although in one sense it was a relief, it was also, you know, just a massive shock as well. Like, what does all this mean? What am I going to do?
You mentioned a sentence, like almost, do you mean like a prison sentence, yeah, or something?
Yeah. That's exactly what I mean. And part of that was because, as you know, I was very, very lucky to be in a psychiatric hospital, and, you know, they were able to explain to me what I would need to do. Now, bearing in mind, I'm somebody from the age of being a teenager, I dealt with every feeling that I'd ever had through using substances to deal with my feelings. And I didn't know this, but I was now told that I couldn't have that anymore, and that I had to do a whole load of things for the rest of my life to be in recovery from this. And it felt like, even though my life was in complete ruin and tatters because of all of the using and the drinking and all that, when somebody said, that's going to be taken away from you, I didn't know how I was going to cope.
Yeah, it was something that was helping you. It was your sort of, I don't know why a safety blanket was coming to mind, but like it is, it was your companion in these times when things were difficult.
You know, the thing with people with, you know, addicts is they sometimes can struggle with their feelings. And in my case, it was my thoughts and my feelings. So it was my racing thoughts that were the bipolar symptom. And I was very definitely self-medicating using alcohol to do that. So I used to really like having hangovers, for example, because when you have a hangover, you like slow your head down. I used to like that. You know, it never occurred to me that that was a strange thing, but I could be, some of my most productive work days would be like having a hangover. So I was using alcohol to self-medicate the symptoms of the bipolarity, and then also just to deal with the ebb and flow of life. It really felt like a sentence, and I had no hope whatsoever that life would be anything other than just completely awful.
Tell me more about what does it feel like to have this busy, like thought spinning, busy mind?
It can feel great. So you can feel like you can solve problems, gain insight into things like really, really quickly. You have this mental sharpness. And I was trying to think about a little analogy for this, and it's a bit like ballet, right? So if you see a ballet dancer just going from move to move to move, you know, beautifully executed, one thing, the next thing, the next thing, it can feel, it feels like that looks, but then sometimes it goes too fast, and it's like that ballet dancer becomes a disheveled, unkempt kind of person wearing rags, moving kind of erratically and it's jaggedly around. So, you know, just a subtle change to what that person's doing, it looks like chaos. And that's what happens when the thinking gets too fast.
It sounds to me like there is this threshold or this point at which it gets too overwhelming or distressing, but it also sounds like there's an element of this creativity or energy that has really helped you.
Yeah, absolutely, which is why many people, when they embark on a journey of treatment for bipolar disorder, they can be very frightened that they're going to have taken away from them what they think is the thing that's been the source of their success. And so certainly for me, I was, yeah, as I started to learn about this, I was thinking, oh, you know, my work success and my academic success and my success with people has been, you know, driven by this fact that I can be sort of have this energy about me and stuff like that. And then it's going to go. And I'm going to be like slow and pedestrian and average and incapable. And you know, it sounds quite arrogant when you spell it out like that. But it is this kind of fear that your innermost personality is going to be taken away from you. And it can also be a bit like this as well. So if you think about the volume being, you know, if you, let's say the volume is just turned up on your thoughts and stuff, and say six is good and seven is bad, right? When someone tells you that this is a disease, right, you simply think, oh my lord, everything that's associated with that is wrong, is an illusion, was cooked up from something that's wrong. And so you think, okay, all the stuff when I was on like 7 out of 10, I can see that. But does that mean that all the stuff that came up when I was 6 on 10, when I was being more creative or when I was just being more charismatic or in a situation, is that also just false? Is that just a disease that's done that? You know, who am I?
Yeah, what was that experience like for you to have those questions?
Really, really hard. And I'd love to say that I was able to kind of work through those questions in an orderly manner, and I just wasn't. I mean, it was just like being hit by a bus, actually. And I struggled, so I didn't make all the changes that I was supposed to do straight away because I just couldn't process it. So it was quite a long, drawn out, painful process of coming to terms with all of that.
Yeah, you mentioned this is a really good point, this idea of having some sort of identity crisis as well, because there were these things that, you know, maybe you were told were symptoms or something, but they were really part of you.
You know, there was all of that stuff around the bipolarity that, you know, going right to the core of things that I think I'd done well. So there was that side of it. There was also the whole addiction thing. And, you know, my kind of addiction is, I forget the word, but it means like poly something. So it means, you know, you're not addicted to one thing, like, you know, alcohol. You're basically addicted to anything, right? So, you know, you pick one substance up, you put another one down. So for me, you know, it could as very much as well be sugar as well as caffeine, shopping. So that was also, you know, I was thinking, okay, all these things that I do, like all these habits that I have, they're also wrong. and on top of that, then you, yeah, if you're lucky, like I was, to be in a psychiatric hospital where they start to delve into all of the why and help you look at the why, you then also, in my case, I also uncovered that there were big kind of psychological injuries really in my past that I'd never dealt with. So I had to rewrite that side of myself as well. So really, when I say hit by a bus and we talk about it, you know, it really does feel like that. So all of that, you sit there and very frightening, like, what am I going to do? All of these things that I thought I was, and all of the direction that I thought I was going in just turns out to be wrong. And I've got to change it all, otherwise I'm going to die.
I'm curious to hear about more of these, some of these things that were happening in your past that came up as a result of, I guess, looking into your past and your recovery.
You know, that one of the kind of theories, I guess, that I was introduced to in the whole sort of program of recovery is that quite often when someone is an addict and someone, you know, has something like bipolar disorder, there can be kind of injury, like psychological, emotional injury that happened in the past. You know, almost everyone who's introduced to this concept struggles, unless there's something so glaringly obvious in their past which they know about. It seems very strange when you think back and you think your life and you think, well, it wasn't that bad, and you know, others have got other things that are much, much worse. So that, you know, the first thing you learn is that trauma is something that just behaves very, very strangely. So trauma, as it was explained to me, so you and I could experience the same thing. You might experience it as a minor thing. For me, if my brain is just more sensitive, that part of my limbic system is more sensitive, which it often is with people like me. The same experience that you and I experienced could be really hurtful for me, and might just leave you fine. And what will happen is that it will sit there. You know, this kind of experience might sit in your limbic system and just never go away. And in my own case, the things that happened to me, there was a lot of trauma for me around my dad. So my dad was a lot older than my mum. He was in his 50s, and my mum was a teenager when I was born. And from what I can piece together, and it's been hard to piece this together, but from what I can piece together, there was a lot of shame about him from my family. And then he died. He died when I was 5 of cancer. And, you know, in spite of all this shame that may have been there, I think, you know, my dad was my dad, and I remember I was asked to I can't really remember much about him, but a therapist said to me, well, what feelings can you remember? And I can remember those feelings. I've got some kind of memory of just warmth and safety, I guess, from being around my dad. And then what happened is that he wasn't there anymore, so he died, and my family went almost completely silent about him. No one would ever answer questions about him. No one would talk about him. There were no, all pictures were destroyed of him. Didn't go to his funeral. And, you know, he was effectively airbrushed out of my life. You know, I'm sure the adults had their own reasons for that. But for me, it was really painful. And I remember being upset as a child about that, obviously, very, very upset. And then I remember just burying it, really. Just, it went away. So to be told at the age of 30 that something that happened to me 25 years ago and continued to happen, you know, during my childhood, but to be told that something like that had affected me was kind of baffling, really, when I was 30. But as I explored it, it turned out that there was an awful lot of stuff from that it was like pain. It was like an injury that had just lodged itself in my brain and never been dealt with. And so much in the way that if you walked around for 25 years with a broken leg, you would be you would be struggling by the time you got to your 30s. I was the same. It's just because it, you know, you can't see it. I didn't know. So
yeah, and it sounds like there was a lot of, like you mentioned, shame and also sort of secrecy around your dad. So this feeling of like, we're not going to talk about him, we're going to sort of put this away. And I'm curious about this whole theme of like secrecy or hiding things. How did that influence you also?
I guess kind of ironic. So I think as a child, you know, there was all this shame. And I think probably very subtle, really. So one of the concepts that was put to me, which was difficult to understand, was that I had inherited a large amount of this shame, and I just as a child absorbed it. By the time I was an adult, I was just like a huge bag of shame in it. And I think, you know, you sort of get in the habit of being like that. So I'm sure that pattern had continued. I just seemed to absorb shame, and And there's a lot of pain in that. Now, it's very common with addicts that they are filled with shame. And of course, what happens is then, as you start to act out in your addiction, you do more things that are shameful. And so you accumulate more and more shame. And they do say that this is one of the most dangerous things about addiction, because it's the shame, you know, the shame that can cause people to kill themselves and suicide, as much as the, you know, the kind of physical effects of being addicted to something.
And at the same time, you know, so you had all of this shame, and then at the same time, you're sort of, let's, you know, fast forward into your early 20s, you're, you know, working in consulting, you're sort of accumulating all of the accolades that are very admired and very sort of high status. So what was that like for you?
Like all of that stuff, looking back, was a real challenge for me, because, and it was a particular challenge when I realized I was ill, because I had the outward trappings of being really successful, right? So I got a great degree. I was working in, you know, a really good career. I was doing well in that. And the idea that there was something fundamentally wrong with my life was really hard to get my head around. So in some ways, those things acted like a real fuel for denial, right? So they were a real kind of source that, so that had to be kind of broken through in order to get better. But there was another thing as well, which is that as I was going through my 20s, there were effectively and increasingly two versions of me. So there was the version of me that went to work and that behaved in a certain way, and then there was the version of me that was the version outside of work, and that was somebody that was very much on his own, completely frightened, paralyzed by fear actually, and drinking on my own to cope with that, and you know, withdrawn socially. You know, the strangeness of being able to be in a situation and be extremely sociable and then out of that situation and completely alone. And so that kind of dual thing just got worse and worse and worse. But it was also just normal. That was just life, right? So I just thought, I think I would have probably thought I had a fairly eccentric and unusual approach to managing my life, but that was it. Might be different from other people, but that was my way. And it, you know, in it, and like I say, it felt like it, you know, until things went really very seriously wrong, it felt like it was paying off because everything was going okay, right?
Yeah, well, I also hear, like, in this context of being a consultant or being sort of in this sort of stereotypical successful job, that you can take on that persona. The context creates the confidence. So being in this context where we know that we're being respected and that there's a lot of other smart people around and all of this stuff, I think it makes sense that it helps and supports your own sense of self. And then outside of that environment, then that's where some of the inner feelings that are not so great and we don't like to always look at them. I mean, everyone has this, but those start to come up. And that's really interesting to me also to hear that parallel.
It was just as you say, there were these two versions of me, and you know, I think this is kind of 10, 15 years ago when this was happening, and I think things are different, or things are changing, and the culture of work is changing. But at the time, I mean, the whole kind of culture of working hard and drinking hard, and you know, I felt like I was a fish swimming with the tide. To be honest, I mean, it was just what people did. So I didn't even imagine that there was anything wrong.
Yeah, but I understand that. It's funny because this whole also like work hard, play hard culture, I think, yeah, I don't know how it is now in the consulting world, but that was something I experienced as well when I was working. And to me, I see also this like a little bit of this theme that you bring up, this notion of like, okay, that we need to be very professional and sort of overly competent and appear very like that everything is pristine in the workplace, and that that would also sort of create this tension or this need to let a bit loose and be more relaxed and be more ourselves. So for me, it made a lot of sense that there was like a lot of happy hours and sort of going a bit crazy with your colleagues, because it was like, okay, we're in this, not in this like professional, structured, stiff coat, because that's what's being expected of us, you know, from our organization or from our clients. And of course we have those elements, but when it's too tight, it's like, there's this feeling of wanting to break out. And so I can see that, like, I think for many, many other people in a different way, but definitely having a theme that comes up. So it makes sense.
Definitely. Yeah.
So, you know, when we talked earlier, you'd mentioned that your recovery is one of the periods of your life that you are most proud of, or the one of the things that you're most proud of. So tell me a little bit more about what that was like for you.
So there was a period, like I said, after being hit by the bus of being stunned, right, and just not knowing where to get, overwhelmed, not knowing where to begin. And so there were some false starts. But then, you know, the kind of recovery process began. And, you know, one thing that happened to me is I had this very kind of powerful and frankly quite strange therapy, which is called trauma reduction therapy. And it involves kind of really, really looking at some of the stuff that happened in the past. And for me, that was the big kind of breakthrough, because I think while I had been intellectually more than ready to accept all of the things that were wrong with me and that I needed to work on, I just didn't feel I had the desire to get better. And, that's the shame piece, right? So I may well know that I'm an addict and with bipolar disorder, but I had no hope and no desire to get better. And then I did this trauma reduction therapy, and it was like it was a catalyst, and it gave me for the first time this glimpse that you know, perhaps there could be some hope, and perhaps I could look after myself. And
can you tell me a little bit more about this? It's trauma reduction therapy.
Yeah, I can.
How does that work?
So this is how it works. Well, I've no idea how it actually works, but I'll tell you what you do. So, what you do is you do it in a very small group. So you do it with a couple of other people and you do it over a couple of days. All the way I did it, it happened over a couple of days. And we would all be effectively, but what the therapists do is they really dig into and try and relive a traumatic episode from your past. And the point of having, so they will have done tons of research in advance to understand what it is, and they'll keep talking to you about it, and your eyes closed, and they're really like reliving this situation, and the other people are witnessing that. So you really basically delve into and explore all of this pain, and it is extremely powerful when you do that with somebody who's when you witness it for somebody else, as well as when it happens to you. So, you know, to give you an indication, when they did this with me, the therapists were having this debate about whether to put towels on the arms of the chairs, and they were saying they decided not to in the end, but they weren't sure. And the reason they said they weren't sure is that they were anticipating me just grabbing the chair with such kind of like they were expecting the anger that was going to come out of me to be so immense that I would have just got, you know, grabbed the chair. So which is, you know, just a way of saying how kind of intense the feelings are. So each of you does a session like that to open up the trauma. And then you have a very weird night after you've done that with everyone, and, you know, you pack it on. And then the next day, what you do is you revisit that situation in the same format, and you deal with it in a, almost as your adult self looking after looking after that child that was, or young person that was affected in that way, and you kind of you re-enter that situation and act in it like a kind of like a functioning adult, basically. So you're kind of, once again, the therapists work on you to take you back in and bring it to life, and you all witness this fruit. And that, it sounds, quite honestly, completely, you know, strange and all of these things. Yeah, how would that work and so on? But it really was incredibly powerful for me. And I think you can, you know, you have to be in the right sort of zone to do these things. But effectively, for me, what happened is that, you know, I went back into that situation and dealt with the pain. And I said things to people that I needed to say to them. You know, I said things to my family. I said things to my dad. And I came out of that situation feeling different. So it was really powerful for me. It was really profoundly helpful.
Thanks so much for sharing that. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, really life-changing stuff. So I did that. And but really, you know, I call that out because it was a real sort of turning moment. But there was tons of other stuff as well. So I began this journey with an awful lot of help and kindness and support from others. You know, I just did what was suggested, really. I did the things that were suggested by the psychiatrist, by the therapist, and I keep on doing those things to this day. And so I think of recovery as an ongoing process, and it, you know, it's something I'll need to do forever. But you know, it's something I've been doing for 9 years now, and my life is completely different, right? It's different in every respect. And how to describe it, it's like a whirlwind, only a positive one. So it's not a whirlwind that destroys things. It's like this process. It's like a sort of a different whirlwind that does positive stuff. But it just sort of tore through every kind of aspect of my life. And I think when I talk about recovery, I mean kind of a mixture of taking medicine. I mean total abstinence from alcohol, and kind of spiritual stuff to kind of be grounded and discover who you are. And so the combination of all three.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit because I'm curious also what it was like, you know, during your recovery period, you were working at EY. And so what was that like for you? What was your relationship with the company in this phase of your life?
Yeah, in one sense, it was very painful. So I did have time off work to do some of this work. And then going back to work was of course a huge trigger of shame, really, for me, because I felt that I behaved in ways that were just dreadful. I'd allowed others to see me in ways that were, you know, just excruciatingly embarrassing, really. And so going back to work was a source of fear. And I think somebody said to me, the hardest thing is getting over the doorstep. And yeah, it was. It really was hard. But I feel a little bit moved talking about this because my gratitude to my employer is absolutely immense, because when I look back and reflect on that journey, I had so much help and kindness from people at work. I wasn't expecting it, but I had it. And, you know, it just really, really helped so much in my recovery. It was difficult, right? It was really hard. I was having to kind of rebuild myself, but I did, and I had a lot of help. And you know, sometimes that help was the subtlest thing, right? So I remember maybe it was about 18 months being back at work. I had to do a presentation, and I remember just somebody who was, you know, a very senior person, very kind of not a very emotional kind of person, very kind of tough sort of person, and I remember him just letting it be known to me that he was going to have my back, and he did it in the most subtle way. And it, you know, it was just little things like that from people I never expected that were just, and that, I just call that out as one example. They were everywhere. And I guess the one thing I'd say is when I did come back to work, I mean, I was not in great shape. Right, some of the people I worked with at first were incredible to me, because what they were able to do was they were like a tugboat trying to get a massive, great, rusty old steamer out of the harbour. And the hardest bit of all is kind of getting the first bit of motion, right? Like, how do you get that massive, how do you do that? How do you, like, or jump starting a car? How do you get it happening? And yet some people were able to do that with me and just find the buttons to press. So they weren't pressing too hard, but they were pressing hard enough to get a reaction. So, you know, when I look back at that kind of, you know, there, people have helped me all the way throughout the process, with, like I say, their kindness. But the people I worked for at first who were able to do that, I think just were, you know, I just have profound and long lasting gratitude for that.
This was now because you had taken a year off from work. Was this something that was out in the open then?
So it was sort of yes and sort of no. So, it was out in the open, but I think one of the things you imagine that when something like this happens to you, you imagine that everyone else has got nothing better to do all day than talk about your terrible fall from grace and all this. But so whilst it was out in the open, it wasn't like a big deal. I don't think it didn't. I mean, it might have been in my head, but I don't think it was for others. And I took a decision to be pretty open about what happened to me.
Yeah, and I'm curious about what your reaction, like when you would share this with someone or share your experience or share your diagnosis, what were the reactions?
One of the things that I've learned is when you disclose this sort of information to colleagues, it's also really important to reassure them. So if you tell somebody that you're an alcoholic, you need them to also know that you're in recovery and that there is absolutely nothing that they need to worry about in terms of your performance. Or if you tell somebody that you've got bipolar disorder, you also need to be able to explain to them that how you manage it and reassure them. Because sometimes people react to fear, you know, oh God, what's this going to mean? You know, so I think there's a way of disclosing things to people that I've learned how to do so that I can do it without shocking them or without unnerving them or without, and I probably, you know, got it. I, you know, it took some practicing to get that right. So, you know, sometimes I was like, didn't say anything at all, and probably I needed to, and other times I've overshared and seen people's faces are like, you know, you didn't need to say that to me. and so I've kind of found something in the middle that works for me, which is that ability to say something, but at the same time to reassure them that when I'm saying it, it's not for something that they need to worry about or even need to do anything about.
Yeah, that you want to share your life experience with them, but there isn't this need to like fix or give advice or worry.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the early things were, you know, I looked a lot healthier very quickly, and people say things like, oh, you know, you look well, which when nobody said that to you for 15 years is quite nice. And so there's those sort of basic things, but then relationships started improving. So you know, relationships with friends and things like that were improving.
What about them improved? How are they different?
Well, when I say improved, I should probably say they were completely transformed. So I mean, I think probably I had been incapable of connecting properly with other human beings for quite some time because of the state I was in. And so in many ways I probably just didn't have very many friendships towards the end. So I started to build, you know, relationships with others based on, you know, mutual trust and interests and things. It was really novel for me to do that, which sounds kind of crazy, but it's true. My working life improved. I was more reliable. I was able to tune into people's feelings and emotions, as well as just kind of tuning into facts and numbers and stuff. So in many ways, I would say it's like this. So all this stuff on the outside started to improve, which is what I was, you know, those things I just mentioned, and all those are very important. But what also happened is that on the inside things improved, and so the person and this is profoundly more important. So the person who was too frightened to do anything and completely filled with shame and loathed himself gradually over a period of time came to like himself, be proud of himself, and feel in control of his life. And so, you know, so that whole inner side was important. And I think one big part of that is when you are suffering from untreated mental illness, you really can't behave in the way that you want to with other people, because you might intend to, but you might act like a complete asshole. That's one of the tragedies of addiction, is that addicts just are really horrible to people that they love. And so when I was in recovery, I wasn't doing that anymore. I was able to act in the right way towards people I love. And, you know, if you think about shame, that hurting people that you love is one of the biggest kind of triggers for shame. And so that wasn't happening anymore because I wasn't doing those things. And so, you know, this kind of journey happened, and it was just very, very positive of kind of, you know, facing up to stuff. It was a period of growth as well. That really has been the story of the second or the last 9 years of my life.
Yeah. So it sounds also like some of these themes around shame and also around loving yourself and around this, maybe the secrecy or the shame that you took on from your father's passing and the whole sort of secrecy in that family, you were able to make some peace with, and in doing so have some peace in yourself.
Yeah, I also think of myself as a work in progress, right? Because these things run very deep. So you can't get rid of them, but you can, it's like a scorpion's tail. You can remove it's still going to have a tail, but you can remove the poison. And I think what I've just learned to do is for it to be like that, really. Yeah. So none of it doesn't bother me anymore. You know, I know all that stuff. I've explored it, but it doesn't have a hold over me, that it used to. And then, you know, it's still there, but it's not, it's completely different from how it was when I was younger.
Yeah. And now I'm curious about your experience now, because, you know, we talked about some of these, for example, these highs or the level 6 out of 10 of the energy and the connected creative thinking. How do you experience that now? And how does that help you?
It's all still there. I take a tiny, tiny, almost homeopathic dose of medicine to just slightly take the edge off it. But it's all still there. And it's extraordinary, really, because now I know what it is and what I'm dealing with. It doesn't affect me. But when I didn't know what it was and I didn't know what I was dealing with, it affected me profoundly. So I still have those highs. I had one relatively recently. I needed to take more medicine, but you know, I knew what it was, right? I knew what was happening, and so we were able to deal with it, and no bad consequences happened, because it's all still there, but I just know how to deal with it. And I think it's like, it's really strange that, I mean, in some ways I'm lucky that that's been my experience as well, because I think there are some people for whom it's harder, but that's been my experience, that I still have these symptoms, but because I know what they are, I know how to behave, I know what to do if it gets too much, I'm able to handle it.
And it sounds to me also that there's like, you know, there's a lot of benefit to having the more mild experience of this, that you can make all of these connections and you can think really strategically. And so it's, yeah, there's, I can hear like the risk or the fear of the overheating, but then on the other ends of the spectrum, it's like, hey, wow, this is actually amazing that this is part of who you are.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. You know, I just embrace all of it. You know, there's also the kind of the slightly frustrating side. So some days I don't really get depressed that much, but occasionally I do. It'll be a week of just having no energy. That can be frustrating as well. It's like, but I know that the way to deal with that is to just let it blow over, and it won't kind of, you know, it's nothing to catastrophize about, kind of thing. And I know that it's just, you know, so you adapt to your patterns around that. Some days, most days, you're going to have this kind of thing that you can work with, and others not. And it's just how I am, right? And Yeah, so it's not the kind of life sentence that I expected it would be.
If you could give yourself a gift in your 20s, like from your now hindsight insight, what would you tell that part of you that was really struggling and feeling shame?
When I reflect on my life now and I reflect on my life then, I think some of the big differences are that now I feel like one person, and then I felt like two. And who, you know, and I, you know, I bring my whole self to work, and I bring my whole self into all the different parts of my life, and really, you know, I've just been so much happier being like that. And I think if I could go back to that person, I would just hope they could be less afraid and more comfortable being their whole self all of the time. So I think I was two things. I didn't really want to be either of them. I didn't want to be this kind of buttoned up management consultant type. And neither did I want to be this kind of frightened, hidden, shame infested person. And that whole sort of thing about becoming yourself and becoming one person, I just wish, I wish I could have grasped that earlier. But it doesn't matter, because I did grasp it, and I've had some phenomenally happy years in my life as a result. So I would say to anyone, really, to, you know, certainly for me, that's something that's just made me so much happier to be my whole self. And I will continue to do my best to encourage others to be like that, and to have the confidence and the courage and feel that they've got the feel that it's okay, really, to be like that and to be who they are, even if they feel very different or they are very different, but that's okay.
Well, thanks so much, Daniel.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah, I mean, I just hope that it's been interesting for people, and that maybe they've heard something that touches them or something that they can identify with.
There were some amazing themes that came up in this discussion. I think one of the things that came up for me that leaves me thinking is this idea of identity. What happens when part of our identity is grouped in with a particular diagnosis? For Daniel, after he got diagnosed with bipolar disorder, he started questioning aspects of himself and of his life, you know, that he had seen really as part of who he was, and all of a sudden were diagnosed and categorized. And are those pieces just symptoms, or are they still a part of who he is? This happens, I think, very frequently in mental health, where our own experience of consciousness, our own personal unique lens, can be then included in a group of symptoms and pathologized in that sense. And so we think, is this really who I am? Or is it just a symptom? But I think this theme also extends beyond just the diagnostic world in mental health. I think it also includes different stereotypes that are projected on us depending on our race, our class, our gender. Once we learn that there are aspects of our own personality that have been sort of absorbed or adopted because of those stereotypes, we question whether that is part of us or part of just a category that we belong to, that our society has labeled us as. And so this dance between our own self-constructed identity and the labels and the symptoms and the stereotypes that are projected on us become much clearer. And when we become conscious of that, can we integrate those two? Can we understand that there are parts of our identity that are projected on us and still see those aspects as unique elements of our own being? I think another theme that really hit hard for me was this feeling of split energies between our personal lives and the professional world. As Daniel mentioned, there was this experience of being in a very professional, very tight, controlled environment in the workplace, which gave him a lot of confidence. but at the same time reinforced this idea that these aspects of himself that he didn't bring into that context were not allowed. And I thought it was such an interesting parallel when we began to talk about in the workplace that we have this whole theme of work hard, play hard. I think this happens quite often. So on the one hand, we have this work hard personality, perhaps, you know, competent, successful, being smart, having the right answers, being controlled. And then on the other hand, this underlying need to bring more of ourselves into the workplace. You know, the parts of us that are maybe more playful or more humorous or a little bit rebellious or a little bit wild. And that's where this play hard theme comes in. You know, that it sort of explodes in the happy hour situations or at the holiday parties. But what if we didn't have those two extremes? What if we could integrate some of those other aspects, those play hard aspects, into our own daily work environment? I wonder whether there would be so much of a need to really let loose at the end of the day if we could just loosen things during our work. And the final theme that sticks with me is this idea that Daniel brought into the conversation of his own experience of mania, the mania aspect of bipolar disorder, that he describes it as the volume being turned up. And sometimes the volume is way too high. And so when I think about how he describes that, I think about many other aspects of ourselves that we may, for example, think that hurt us. But perhaps it's just because the volume is turned up too loud. And it doesn't mean that we have to turn it off, that we have to completely get rid of it, but that we can turn the volume a bit down and use elements of those experiences that are incredibly powerful for us in society. So the discussion of healing, of recovery, moves more into the sense of finding balance than it does of further shaming, disowning, and suppressing energies and experiences that are part of us. Thanks again so much for listening. I really, really would love to hear your thoughts about these episodes and what's resonated for you. If you like what you just heard, please check out our website at www.breakdownwakeup.com. If you subscribe to our mailing list, you'll get weekly updates about episodes and special events. We also have a growing community of people who are getting excited about this concept and sharing their own thoughts and reactions. Finally, if you're trying to discover the underlying wisdom within your own breakdown and need some help, we've designed special programs to help do just that. Thanks again for listening, and remember, when things are breaking down, important wisdom is waking up.